This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. It was May when black activists first led protests over George Floyd's killing by police. There were organizations that responded immediately, stating without ambiguity, Black Lives Matter. Others stayed silent. It wasn't until the second half of July that the Sierra Club joined the conversation in full with a blog post from its executive director titled, Pulling Down Our Monuments.
The Sierra Club is directly calling out the questionable past of its famous founder.
After 128 years, the club is rethinking John Muir, a man who has quietly bothered historians and environmentalists for some time.
John Muir, celebrated as the visionary behind the national parks, referred to Native Americans and black people as lazy and dirty, conditions that he referred to as chronic and hereditary in his writings. These are not the qualities talked about in histories like The National Parks by documentarian Ken Burns.
By 1903, John Muir was 65 and more famous than ever. Mountain peaks and canyons, campsites and glaciers now bore his name.
Here's Ramon Cruz, the newly elected president of the Sierra Club, in an interview for CBS affiliate KPIX.
If we want to be part of a movement that centers justice and equity, then we need to be sure that we come to terms with our past.
But Ramon doesn't mean just the past of John Muir. He means the past of the entire conservation and environmental movement.
He's not the only one that they were calling on today?
Yeah, they really spoke to sort of a...
Not long after the Sierra Club's blog post, another long-lived environmental powerhouse, the Audubon Society, put out its own statement about John James Audubon, the naturalist and slaver for whom the organization is named. It seems like the beginning of a substantial reckoning for the environmental movement. But is it? And will it be sustained? Dorcita Taylor is an environmental sociologist at the Yale School for the Environment.
I remember going to a John Muir conference back around 1998, 99. They used to have these things annually, and bringing up the issue of his racist statements and just about almost being drummed out of the conference. I was literally verbally attacked by somebody saying, why would you want to kind of desecrate the name of this environmental hero? And of course, being a conference of several hundred people, and I was the only non-white person in the room, it was very interesting because most of the people at the conference didn't really believe what I was saying. And so for somebody like myself who has studied his diary since the early 1990s, you see this writing, but you don't see it being put beside his accomplishments. In fact, in some of the diaries and some of the early works, when you look at them, you see where scholars were deliberately leaving out some of the very offensive things that he said.
As you have just laid out here, people have been pointing out the fact that the environmental movement is, in fact, very white, and that many of its founders were linked to this strain of American racism for literally years. And to crib a phrase from NPR's Code Switch podcast, like, why now, environmental groups?
Yeah, good question. Why now? I think a lot of people have, for the first time, really been reading and finding out about this material. So, for instance, if we look at my book, The Rise of the Conservation Movement, Power, Privilege, and Environmental Protection. Well, this book has been showing up on a lot of environmental book club reading lists. And I suppose for some people, they're kind of realizing that there are a lot of things that gets taken for granted in the environmental movement. I think environmentalists for a long time have held up that race has nothing to do with environment or has very little to do with environment. Things like inequality, they see as social issues, not environmental issues. The activities that we've seen over the last year, which are so egregious. So someone like Chris Cooper, who is sitting in Central Park, bird watching, a random white woman can decide that she's going to criminalize and demonizing him, even though she's the one breaking the rules. That strikes a lot of environmentalists as profoundly wrong. The killing of George Floyd. And so it's trying to make sense of those. Ahmaud Arbery, every environmentalist will tell you, go for a jog in the fresh open air. It's healthy. It's good for you. Well, this Black man did. And he got hunted down in the most egregious, terrible way. So if environmentalists then make that first step into saying, these things are wrong, these things are racist, they're discriminatory, they have to start thinking about it, talking about it, trying to look at their own work. And so we see leaders are now leaning in to this discourse. There's a long way to go still.
So back in 2014, you wrote a fairly damning report that outlined the lack of diversity inside environmental organizations like the Sierra Club and Audubon. And then another couple of years later, you showed that the number of environmental groups that were actually publishing diversity statistics had gone down since that first report. Can you tell us more about that work?
Yes. So one of the things, if we're talking about diversity, then we really have to track it and understand, how are we changing from our baseline? So one of the things I thought we should do was to go from 2014 and then look to see how many of these organizations have really started to collect diversity data on their staff, on their boards, membership, and are they sharing that data publicly? And what we did find was that it was around 4%. So most of the organizations were not doing it. I have some new data that follows up and asks the question, why are they not releasing data? Why are they not collecting and releasing the data? All of this data, of course, was collected before the summer of 2020. And there were quite a number of organizations that really still push back on the idea that diversity was necessary, important, or something that they should do. This comes primarily from small, all-white, or very, very white organizations, many of them rural. When we ask, if you do collect diversity data, why do you do it? And most of them actually do it to get funding. The other reasons that we saw coming up were organizations that felt that they wanted to look more like the communities in which the organizations are located, or look like the communities that they're trying to serve. Diversifying the board also was something that came up. So we saw that there was definitely, in this new report, definitely some increased movement around diversity, but there is definitely a strong amount of pushback from groups around the validity of it, or the idea that it has anything to do with their mission. And you know, they would say, they'd make comments like, we just go out and hire qualified people. We're not interested in diversity.
Well, right along those lines, in their blog post, the Sierra Club said that they themselves had had to push back against their own members who say that, you know, the Sierra Club should sort of stay in their lane on and just worry about the environment. And there was a letter to the editor in the Richmond Times-Dispatch in which the reader directly challenged the Sierra Club itself, saying that Muir wasn't a racist and that was, in fact, a quote, admirer of Native Americans. And so, you know, it seems
the person clearly has not read his diaries.
But I think what makes this interesting, right, is that you hear this all the time from sort of rank and file environmentalists, is just a desire to push aside these concerns.
Right. So if we go back to Muir, he was a very prolific writer, and he chronicled literally his daily movements. So he has over 20,000 diary entries, and I've seen you know, over 19,800 of them, right? So no one would argue, and I wouldn't argue, that every single entry about Native Americans was absolutely racist. What you do see, if you look at the sum total of it, are phraseologies, words. So the words dirty, the words quote unquote savage. You look at those descriptions, you look at when he goes to Alaska and what he does. There was an incident with where a Native American, one of the Native American men who were kind of deckhands and helping out on this boat he was on, they sent this man to hunt, and the man comes back with a kill and says, "Oh, I picked out the best one of all the ones I killed." And John Muir whips off his belt and runs after this man to whip him and lash him. Would he have done that to any of the white men? He describes people as hideous looking. He never describes white middle-class people as hideous in any of his diary entries. So those things we have to understand. We're not demeaning them. We're just putting that on the record along with their environmental thoughts. Muir wrote very terrible things about Black people after they fed him and gave him a place to stay at night after he'd been walking all day. He sat and he looked at this Black family. And again, he describes the ugliness, the way how he thought they couldn't be of the same human species as he. What part of that is not racist? He goes to Brazil, and when he goes to Brazil, he hangs out with slave owners on these slave plantations and again sees Black people enslaved, but it doesn't strike him as something to comment on as he's writing about our immorality in the way we deforest, in the way we don't take care of the environment. He doesn't see people as a part of what he should be concerned with, or Black people, and it isn't a part of his discourse. How is this relevant today? The environmentalists who don't see Black people, Latinx, Asians, Native Americans, and their plight as a part of what they do in the environment, they're simply replicating those behaviors of divorcing environment from the plight of humanity.
And I guess what for me is revealing about that letter to the editor is that if you put yourself in the shoes of environmental organizations, those letters to the editor might be coming from people who are donors to these organizations that fund their operations. And so perhaps that's part of the answer for the question that came earlier, you know, why did this take so long?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they're definitely under pressure. The presidents, the leaders, the senior staff, to either just ignore it, or why do we have to talk about it? Or they will make an argument that was the 19th century. Things are different now. But the challenge is, if we never recognize and acknowledge those things, we tend to repeat and make those mistakes.
And so what do you think that next step is in terms of actually confronting this history? I guess the question is, what are some of the core concepts of environmentalism that you'd like to see reexamined, or perhaps are there any that should be really thrown out?
So I'll focus on reexamining and moving forward. And I think we have to come to a more widespread decision and understanding that social and political structures influence environmental outcomes and environmental behaviors and processes. And that is still something that's very much debated, and that is still something that especially the old guard in these environmental organizations really still at their deepest, most instinctual level see a disconnect between the two. And until we can see that these things are very connected, we will continue to put forward policies that inadvertently or deliberately have negative impact on some people and some communities and benefit others.
That was Dorcida Taylor, an author and environmental sociologist at the Yale School for the Environment. You can read more about her work at nhpr.org.